You're listening to episode 28 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with Mark Dino. Running time for this episode is 44 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
This is Julia.
This is John.
And joining us today for an interview is Mark Dino.
Hello.
All righty. We're going to introduce Mark and explain who he is and why you ought to know the man and love the man, even if you have not been the man. But first, we got two things we want to knock out. I want to give a shout out here to someone. John, it's appropriate that you've got some sake there. So I want to give kind of a moment of silence or a very solemn shout out here to a gentleman by the name of Specialist David Tyler Proctor. And Specialist Proctor was a close associate of one of the booters who was deployed to the Middle East and unfortunately was gravely injured over there, came back and hung on for a little while and did not make it. And so I just want to say to Specialist Proctor, to the family, that we appreciate the sacrifice that was made there. We at Fear the Boot have a long history of giving props and high regard to the people in the armed services, and obviously, in this case, a young man made the ultimate sacrifice. So I want to kind of give a moment of respect and love and support to the friends and family that were left behind. And Specialist Proctor, wherever you are out there, this one's for you, buddy. On a similar note, but a little bit lighter, if you want to donate to puppies who have given their lives for America.
Damn you, Derek. You know how to pick them.
Yeah.
I love these charities.
I know. But, okay. So I finally have up the details. I managed to post those online. I got all the details from Derek, and they now post online. I put it in a blog post, but I know our blog is not super active, so a lot of people don't check it apart from the podcast feed. So it is now out there. I will link this in the show notes so you can find it there as well. If you are coming to Fear the Con, there's going to be a raffle. He's got two, what he's calling bags of holding, that are going to be filled with all kinds of great stuff. He's going to be raffling both of those off. If you are not coming to the convention, I hope that you will still consider making a donation to these charities, because these really are great charities. It's for rehabilitating and finding homes for animals that have served the armed forces. In some cases, they've come back with issues where they need rehabilitation. In other cases, you know, they just kind of need to be placed in homes and whatnot. So I really hope you'll consider giving to that charity. And if you are coming to Fear the Con, please bring a few extra bucks for the raffle, because it's some great prizes. And even if you don't win, it's a great cause. Every year, Derek has run the raffle. I have donated to it and told him from the outset, I don't even want to win. Do not even include me in the raffle. I just want to give something to these causes.
Yeah, I'm definitely throwing in money for both of these, because he has two separate charities that are both military dog related. One of them being actually the rehabilitation of military dogs, but the other being training to be service animals as well.
Yeah.
So I mean, both of these are really good charities.
Yeah, that's the other aspect of it, is there's also animals in there who may not have directly served in the armed forces, but there are people coming back to their homes who maybe because of injuries they sustained overseas need some kind of a service animal, and so they're working to train these animals to provide these people what they need.
Yeah, and I'm a sucker for a dog charity, so
I know this
they've got
me
my
sad.
Money.
I think between appealing to the pro-military people and the pro-animal people, Derek has somehow managed to move every single human being on the earth.
Somehow,
so
yes.
I hats off to Derek.
Yeah.
It's like the only Oprah episode I've ever cried to is the military dog one.
And now it's coming to Fear the Con.
I know. Now I'm going to cry at Fear the Con.
All right. Let's move on here to the issue at hand, which is our discussion here with Mark Dino. Mark, let's start this off in the good old classic Fear the Boot way. Tell us a little bit about who you are, what you've done, where people ought to know you from, and then we're going to move into what you're working on right now.
I have to admit, I feel a little inadequate compared to the resumes of some of the RPG industry people that you have interviewed, but I'm a freelance writer for Catalyst Game Labs on the Shadowrun line. So if anybody recognizes my name, it'll be on Shadowrun products. The first one that I have writing credits on is the Seattle 2072 source book in which I wrote two extremely small short stories, but that was enough to get my foot in the door. And then I was in the Catalyst freelancer pool and was able to pick up jobs from there. My most significant contribution there was in the Runner's Toolkit product. And if you don't know, Runner's Toolkit is kind of a box set that has a whole bunch of things to enhance your Shadowrun game. But one of the things in there was a leaflet called PAX, which stands for Pre-Generated Auxiliary Character Creation System. And I was kind of the principal designer and writer on that system. And what it is it's something to speed up your Shadowrun character creation process by taking all of the myriad choices that you have in Shadowrun character creation and globbing them together in pre-calculated packages so that when you have a character concept, you can just go along and kind of pick from this smorgasbord of choices for whatever fits your character concept. And it's really modular and it really speeds up the Shadowrun character creation process.
I like that idea quite a bit.
I like it too. And I'll tell you right now, that is one of the things that I wish more game companies would put out, is those kinds of resource kits, because it has struck me through my years of running and playing games that oftentimes the help they give you in terms of, oh, here's three books of equipment, here's tons of pre-generated plots. Okay, there's a role for that. I'm not saying I'm against these things, but at the end of the day, what I really want as a game master is stuff that's going to fill out the areas between my major contributions to the game. So I've written a plot, but I need a few ideas for some NPCs. I need a few minor little area descriptions. I need some kind of pre-gen personality quirks, or maybe they've run into a group of bad guys that need some stats for that. And it's the kind of things like that, those resources that just help fill in the blanks between the big points of the story I'm telling, that I love to see from game companies. And so, Mark, I think it's great that you did that. And that's the sort of thing that I hope the folks at Catalyst will continue to support and to do, both for Shadowrun and then also for the Battletech line as well.
Yeah, as a GM, I'd love to take NPCs and just tweak them and introduce them into the game, because I don't want to go through a lot of the statting of NPCs. And I'm not Chad, so I'm not just going to take my players and put a new name on them.
Well, one of the things that I always did, especially back in the editions of Shadowrun that I played real heavily, which was 2nd and 3rd. I own 4th, as I said before on the show, but I've not played it real heavily. But in playing 2nd and 3rd editions, I cannot tell you how many times that I used either the contacts, which had stats, or the character archetypes, which I never actually used for character generation, but I would use those all the time as NPCs. You know, if I needed half a dozen random hooligans, I would just flip over to the ganger archetype page, and that would become, you know, who's on the street. And I might change up their weapons or stats just a little bit to give them some kind of diversity, but it was a great resource.
Well, in all honesty, Shadowrun can be a little overwhelming whenever you're trying to make a character too, with all the mods mm-hmm. you can put on them. Mm-hmm. There's so much you can do to your character in many different ways, so that really does help.
Oh, yeah. Try to calculate out the essence on the fly.
Right.
Especially when spells may target the essence of a character, so that's important.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mark, as of right now, I know that you are involved with the 5th edition of Shadowrun. Where exactly is that at in terms of its production and release cycle? Is this going to be a Gen Con release? When is this coming up?
I can't answer that question.
You cannot answer that question. Okay. But you can at least tell us it's in progress. I know that because
it is in development.
It is in development. Okay. Can you tell us anything about where it's at in terms of its production cycle, even if it's vague terms here? Are you guys concepting it? Are you past concepting it to writing it?
It is approaching its end. Internal playtesting has been going on for quite some time.
Okay, good, awesome. Good. Okay, so that gives us some idea of where it's at. Okay, so the actual release, we'll wait until Catalyst gives an announcement here, because obviously we want, you know, Mark to give us all the info we can, but we don't want to cost him his job in the process, so we respect that. All right, so Mark, one of the things that I want to talk to you about here, now, of course, for those of you at home that are listening to this, what I want to do with this episode is I want to use Shadowrun 5th Edition as something of a case study. Because we're certainly going to ask what questions we can about 5th edition and see what answers Mark is able to give us, and at least from some of the preliminary notes he sent me in terms of what Catalyst has given him permission to say. This is a lot more than most game companies, especially mid to large size game companies, are willing to let people say about their games prior to release. But I still think, even if you're the sort of person where you don't like Shadowrun, you don't want to touch it, whatever, maybe we can win you over in this interview. Even if we don't, what I think we can do with this interview that is applicable to the game industry as a whole, some insight into how game development works. Because we've talked to a lot of people that come from the smaller, more independent side of game development. And I recognize when you talk about an RPG company, even when you say a big RPG company, in relative terms, we're still not talking about a big company here. But relative to other game companies, Catalyst obviously is a decent sized and successful game company, okay? Sure, this is not exactly making it onto the Forbes list, but
none, they have office space and they're not in a basement.
Yeah, okay, we'll put it that way. So I hope that something that we kind of pull back the curtain on here is what game development looks like in a larger and more structured environment. So, Mark, let's start there. How did you first get involved with Catalyst and with Shadowrun writing, or game writing in general?
Okay. The very start of it was me being an eager fanboy and volunteering. There was a product that came out. It was Ghost Cartels. It was a Shadowrun plot book about a really interesting plot about a new awakened drug that makes an extreme splash and turns up the streets of Shadowrun. And for the most part, I thought it was a fantastic product. The plot ideas in it were really well done, but the book stumbled out of the gate in some of its execution. It was plagued by some really unfortunate problems that were traced back to perhaps a lack of manpower in proofreading or consistency or editing departments. And it just kind of stumbled out of the gate there. And, you know, there were some mistakes in some of the NPC stat blocks, which they later released errata for corrections for. But still, it was unfortunate that what I thought was such a good overall product, such a good core idea, was kind of dogged by those mistakes. So I sent an email to the General Catalyst contact and I just said, hey, I love your products and I want to help. I think I can help. I know a lot of the meta plot. I'm really strong on the game stats. I would like to volunteer to help you guys in any way you can, anything you want me to do. I will work for free. Just let me know. And then surprisingly faster than I expected that I got an email back from somebody and they were putting together a pool of proofreaders for upcoming products. And the very first product that we were tasked to work on was the then ultra top secret Shadowrun 25th anniversary core rulebook. So Catalyst kind of took over the Shadowrun line in the middle of 4th edition, and they decided that they wanted to re-release the core rulebook to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Shadowrun, which was a major relayout of the core Shadowrun rules and was a rewrite of them in the case of the Matrix chapter. But more especially, it was an enhancement of the production values. So I worked as a proofreader starting on the 20th anniversary core rulebook and then through all of the products that followed that up until Seattle 2072. And I was working on proofreading Seattle 2072 when they put out an email to all of their proofreaders saying, hey, we're looking to have short pieces of fiction to introduce kind of every chapter and every subsection pretty much within each chapter. So if any of you would like to submit stories, then we'll consider them. You might get them published. I was always interested in writing more fiction and was interested in getting more involved in freelance writing and Shadowrun in particular. So I submitted two stories. They're 750 words, one page, basically. I submitted two stories and got two stories accepted. So if you scour it in Seattle 2072, my stories, the first one is in the history chapter, introduces the Renraku Arcology shutdown event, which was one of my favorite settings. So I knew I could write a short story for that one. And then the second one introduces the Bellevue district of Seattle. After that, I was in the door of the freelancing.
I'm glad that Catalyst chose to go that route because, first off, any company is very wise to use their fans in any way they can. And I don't mean use in the negative sense of the word. I mean leverage them. If these people want to be involved, I remember back when I was doing fan writing for Battletech, and when I sent it into MechForce North America and they wanted to pick it up, I mean, I was just so ecstatic to contribute to the setting. ultimately as a business, what I was creating for them was a saleable product.
Yeah, and I'm sure you told everyone you knew,
oh yeah,
I'm going to be in this, yes, and then they bought copies.
Precisely. Yeah,
but then secondly, going back to the FASA days, if you were to compile all of FASA's works, probably the single largest book in their collection would be one entitled Errata. And so bringing in some proofreaders who kind of have that, you know, fan vibe, who are going to dig through all the numbers and really see if this all balances out. For example, FASA did not seem to understand their own rules don't allow for a half ton of SRM 4 ammo in the Orion. People play Battletech know what I'm talking about. But the point being, though, that I'm glad that they chose to go that route. In your case, it sounds like, obviously, you went beyond just being a fan to, I don't know if this has become a full-time career or not, but at least it's become a paid endeavor of some level.
I was going to call something on the pay, but I'm not going to say so.
Let me ask it this way, though. Is your work for Callus, is this what you do as a full-time job, or is this something that you do in addition to another job?
Oh, definitely in addition.
In addition to another job.
I could definitely do more work writing for Catalyst, but no, it's definitely a side job.
Yeah, and this is something that we've heard in many other interviews as well, is if you're going to get into the RPG industry, unless you have an extremely low standard of living, you better love it, because your enjoyment of what you're doing is the primary thing you're going to get out of this, not fat stacks of paper. You know, contrary to what everyone thinks, the vast majority of people in the RPG industry are not sitting around stacking bills all day. So
sleeping in their huge beds.
Yeah. Sleeping in their Scrooge McDuck gold piles.
It's definitely a labor of love, and by far the payment that you receive is working on something that you enjoy and contributing to something perhaps larger than yourself that somebody else can enjoy. And if you were to just look at the dollars per hours that you're putting in, it's one of the worst career choices that you could have. But it's a labor of love for sure.
Still outpaced podcasting.
So let's move forward to Shadowrun 5th edition. I mean, now we're going from peripheral fiction or little vignettes to the core rules. How did you get involved in the core rules? And if you're able to tell us, what exactly is your involvement in the core rules? What are your contributions to Shadowrun 5th edition?
Just kind of picking up the story where I left it off there.
Sure.
Once I was in the freelancer pool, then I started to pick up jobs and do things there. And as I said before, one of my major contributions was PAX. And I guess I'm speculating a little bit because I don't know other people's minds, but I'm fairly sure I developed a reputation as somebody that was very solid in the rules department. And in fact, I have credits in the writing of many products that I only really contributed NPC stats for. The line developer of Shadowrun, Jason Hardy, would often email me towards the end of a product's life cycle and say, Mark, I need a few stat blocks generated on short notice, and I would be able to turn that around. All of us in the freelancing pool kind of knew that Shadowrun 5 was brewing sometime, that we would have to start development sometime, but we didn't know any of the exact timings. And then, kind of out of the blue, I received an invitation that Jason and the rest of the staff at Catalyst were forming a small kind of core group of freelancers, which they kind of dubbed or christened the Rules Committee. And it was going to be our job to outline the skeleton, the base framework for Shadowrun 5th edition. And the idea here was that this was going to be something of a little more significance. We weren't tasked with just creating the rules framework for a core rulebook. The idea is we would be creating the rules framework for the entire edition and lay kind of the guardrails or the framework of where it is all going to go, not just the core rulebook, but ideas for future rules. We refer to them as splat books, these rule add-on books. So it was our job to take what was coming in the form of fairly broad concepts, wide objective goals for the edition, and flesh them out a little bit more to give it some solid rules structure to create that framework there that would then be built upon in more detail.
So I'm really curious how you approach that. Do you take the previous games and try to work from there, or do you just start from the ground up to create this framework?
In this particular case, we definitely use Shadowrun 4 as a basis, because that was one of the mandates coming out of the initial, I guess they called it kind of a summit by the staff of Catalyst. They all got together and they decided on a very, very high level the direction that they wanted Shadowrun 5th edition to go. And they kind of gave us a handful of bullet points. I remember one of them, because it was catchy, was evolution, not revolution. And so that was basically the mandate saying, don't completely reinvent the wheel. Use SR4 as a basis point and fix what needs to be fixed and leave alone what we believe works and achieves our objectives.
Let me back up a question really even prior to that. And this is not a rhetorical question. This really is genuine curiosity. What motivated a fifth edition? What made them decide we need to replace the current Shadowrun rules and setting architecture? I mean, I realize they're not completely replacing, as you said, you know, evolution, not revolution. But I think when you look at this from a consumer's perspective, there are, broadly speaking, I think two motivations that are attributed to a company that's making a new edition. And I don't know that either of these is always accurate or really speaks to the nuance of what goes on in game development. But nonetheless, it's going to be typically one of two things, which is either one, the system is fundamentally broken and has to be replaced. There is something so hideously wrong with the game as it is that we need a new edition to fix it. Or it's a shameless cash grab. I mean, to be blunt, the best way to make money is if you can't keep selling any more players' handbooks is to make the player handbook outdated. Now everyone has to rebuy the books they already own.
Yeah, and out of sight, out of mind. A new edition is new on the shelf. Yeah.
But if your new edition is too different, the players may find a path to an alternative source of enjoyment, and you may lose lots of revenue.
They may sally forth from your addition,
indeed,
and find a path that is closer.
It sounds like the Shadowrun folks deliberately decided not to provoke such a pathfinding reaction, and I think that was wise of them, because I haven't bought D&D in 6 years.
Yeah. So I am curious, what motivated them to say the 20th anniversary edition or 4th edition, whatever you want to call it, is not what we want to stick with? We want to do a 5th edition.
Honestly, you'd have to ask them specifically, but I do know that eventually an RPG needs to be cycled over. You reach a point where a particular edition has kind of reached the end of its useful life cycle. Far from it being a cash grab, when you actually look at the dates, since the original SR4 sourcebook was released, and this was back when the license was under WizKids and FanPro, not Catalyst, 4th edition has actually been the longest edition of any other Shadowrun. So I don't think you can call it a cash grab in any way, shape, or form. I do know that there have been numerous cases where we have discussed things as freelancers about mechanics or aspects of the game that we're not entirely happy with. But in many cases, the conclusion came that this can't be fixed by releasing further source books. To fix this properly, we'd have to change something fundamental in the game, and we don't want to change something that fundamentally. We don't want to disturb that by just releasing an errata or whatever. This needs to wait until a new edition. So many of those ideas have been queued up over years and years and years of Shadowrun 4 being played. And I can't tell you why particular now, but the PTBs, the powers that be at Catalyst, decided that now's the time so we can engage these ideas that we've been waiting on.
Now, out of curiosity, and I don't know that you're going to know an answer to this, so I suppose I'm really kind of asking maybe more for your intuitive sense than maybe anything you're directly privy to, but how much of that do you feel is driven by the fact that Shadowrun leans up against a looming future? If you look at a game like Battletech or D&D, they're so far detached from reality that almost anything they say really kind of fits pretty easily within a suspension of disbelief. But with Shadowrun, you know, in its original start date of 2050, you're talking about a point in time that is now only, what, 37 years in the future?
Yeah, we may be alive for it.
Yeah, and if you look at
if there's pervasive computer connections everywhere one day and we all carry around little computers?
Yeah, well, I'll get to technology in a minute, because cyberpunk and technology as a whole is an entire area I want to talk about. But especially some of the events that were described in, Julie, what was the section called? Is it How It Came to Pass or Now It Came to Pass? Or
I think, isn't it Now That?
There was a section that set up the history of how the world got to be the way that it was, going back to like second and third editions. And if you look at many of those dates, we have already passed some of those dates.
Yeah, it's really funny when you read back on even some of the later, earlier editions, I should say.
Mark, did that kind of thing come up in the conversations of, you know, the future is now, and so the game is starting to feel dated?
That didn't come up in discussions of when to do a new edition, but it definitely did come up as part of discussions about developing the overall feel of what we wanted out of the edition, how we wanted to establish feel. There was a lot of good discussions in that respect. So maybe I'll go into a little bit about what we were doing there. There was this initial rules committee that we established kind of the bones of it. But once we started to open up Shadowrun to the wider development team and started to really do the actual nuts and bolts of writing it, there was a lot of diverse viewpoints brought in. And in discussion I had with Jason prepping for this interview, he told me that they intentionally brought in a wide array of viewpoints, people that they know had differing viewpoints. And he told me that they anticipated and expected conflict to arise from this amongst the writers. And they believe that that would be for the betterment of the game. And I think that they're right, because I don't know if you've ever worked on a creative project. If you bring people in that are just yes men, like, hey, yeah, it sounds good, that's great, it doesn't really drive you to excel. But if you bring in somebody else that is really pushing on your ideas, like, no, why did you do this? Do you really think that's the best way? What about this instead? That's when those ideas are going to kind of come through the refining fire and come out better. So we did indeed have a large pool of people. We had people that were extremely passionate about making the game accessible to new players. We had people that were really big meta plot, I can't call them like gurus, people that knew the long history. We had people that were really passionate, loved the classic cyberpunk Shadowrun, wanted lots of that. We had other people that were more interested in making Shadowrun more progressive or more in line with our modern view of how we project the future to going to be today, as opposed to a 1980s view of the future. You know, we had people that designed things more by feel, like this kind of feels right as far as how the game plays. And we had people that were real kind of math geeks and would break apart the numbers and mathematically analyze and derive a formula. And then that's how we designed. And all of these people came together, all driven by an extreme passion to make Shadowrun and make it the best game that we possibly could. What you're going to see in Shadowrun 5th edition is a product of all of our work together. For like one little example, there was a thread that started that was about trolls and the race of trolls and balancing them in the edition, that quickly exploded to multiple hundreds of posts amongst the freelancers. And the conclusion at the end of it was to actually go back and scrap the character generation system that we had originally planned for and redo it, because we saw that the troll problem, quote unquote, as we saw it, just wasn't going to be addressed without a serious redo of the character creation system.
I've got to ask, what is the troll problem?
Well, they were just difficult to balance because their stats are so radically different than everyone else. They're the most extreme. They have massive bumps in their physical stats and massive deficiencies in some of their mental stats. And that was game mechanics wise, rules crunch wise behind the scenes, that made it really difficult to balance them as a viable choice. We found in discussing things that it seemed far too quickly to tip one way or the other. If you kind of broke down the numbers of what you were getting for your choice as troll, as a meta type, it would either be way too expensive or way too cheap. You know, it either became a non-viable choice or a no-brainer choice. So in an effort to resolve that situation, we had to go back and redo the character creation system.
Now, Mark, I got to stop here and give a bit of meta podcast and give you some high props for something here. So I'm glad to finally meet another organized mind, because prior to this show, you sent me an outline that goes three layers deep. And I want to say I appreciate that, because typically I'm just working with these drunk hooligans who are busy making Iron Man hump Care Bears. And I know. there's no level of organization of the show.
I've put together outlines a couple times.
I sacrificed my ring for this.
Yeah,
my earring.
And I can't even say on the episode, what you did with that earring, because I'm on point 1H here. Within your outline. But you bring up something in that point, which is one of the things that we kicked around on a prior episode of this show, which is the way that the artwork of Shadowrun, at least in my opinion, and John, I believe, shares this opinion as well, in a way doesn't convey what the game is about. Because if you look at Shadowrun in terms of its world events and its history, it does a great job of capturing many of the classic tropes of cyberpunk. The dystopia, the rise of the corporations, the kind of the loss of the individual and the shuffle. if you look at all of these things that they've written about Shadowrun, about where corporate rights start to interfere with public rights and things like that, and when does the corporate action or an economic action...
good is the public
good. Yeah, precisely. Is an economic action...
Just read Saratech and or Citizens United.
But one of the things about the artwork of the game is it doesn't always do a good job of capturing that. Because social struggle is hard to convey in a piece of freelance art. But a cyborg elf with a mullet and a laser gun, which is clearly what the future would look like, according to the 1980s, that makes something that's real easy to put on the cover of second edition. And so you have your kind of a note on conforming the artwork to the vision of the game. And I was wondering if you talked to that a little bit. What was the process like with the artwork?
Well, I don't know if this is unique to Shadowrun or RPG development or not. I just know my experience of working with Shadowrun. But we were given the opportunity to view, it seemed like, almost every art piece that was coming in for Shadowrun 5th edition and give our feedback on it and corrections. And it's been posted publicly. The cover for Shadowrun 5th edition actually went through some fairly extensive modifications based on the feedback that the freelancers gave to really convey a strong image of what we always imagined Shadowrun to be like. And so as the art pieces are coming in, we have been continuing to give feedback to the art director that turns them back to the artist on what we would like to see and how we view things. And almost every image gets changed from its original sketch or its original state. And sometimes they get changed dramatically. And I think overall, the quality of the art in Shadowrun 5th edition is going to be taken up a notch again and is going to really strongly tie with the world as you hear it described. And my notes is no more flying cars. There's an infamous art piece, which is actually the cover of the old New Seattle book from 3rd edition, which depicted this weird kind of car thing with some jet turbines on it that some guys were hanging off of. And anyone that's a real fan of Shadowrun will look at that thing and, you know, kind of mentally flip through the stats of all the vehicles that they've ever seen and come to the conclusion there is nothing even remotely like that in the entire Shadowrun universe.
Well, not only that, but even the regular cars are better than anything hovercraft wise, in my opinion.
So as you guys approach 5th edition, what is the feel you're going for? Now, I realize it's kind of asking you to define life in short, but as much as you can possibly encapsulate or abstract something like that, what is the feel you're going for with the 5th edition Shadowrun?
Yeah, I think I can encapsulate that because okay. It comes from the overall design goals that the line developer Jason outlined for us. And I'm going to be re-summarizing a blog post that he put up on the Shadowrun development blog. But for those who haven't heard it, here are the key design points behind Shadowrun 5th edition. Kind of the first one I'd kind of already touched on was, in general, we like Shadowrun 4th edition. This is the evolution, not revolution. So we're not going to dramatically change everything. We're not overturning it. The core mechanics are going to remain the same. You're still going to have attribute plus skill forms your dice pool. It's going to be even more consistent than it was in Shadowrun 4th edition. I'll get to that. Fixed target numbers are staying. So you are still going to roll, and you're going to count your fives and sixes, and that determines how well you do on a test, right? For those of you who haven't played Shadowrun before, but you've played the board game Arkham Horror, the dice system is exactly the same. It's a multiple die system, right, where the modifiers modify the number of dice that you roll rather than what you're looking for roll, and you just count your fives and sixes. It's a really quick system to resolve your tests. We're keeping Shadowrun 4's strengths as we see them, and building upon them. Here's a really key one. And if the entire edition had a catchphrase, this is it. Everything has a price. One of the things in analyzing Shadowrun 4th edition that we saw, especially as the further splat books and more gear books started to come out, we felt that there was too much that was given away without consequence. In analyzing
BioWare.
Totally. I utilize that.
Yeah. BioWare in particular. I'll admit my knowledge was a little bit outdated.
Oh yeah. I used it like crazy.
Yeah. Cyberware, except no essence cost.
Right, right. Like, I think I had men melting at my feet with some of the stuff I put in my body. It was really bad.
Shadowrun 4th edition BioWare did have essence cost, but you separated cyber and bio essence, then you halved whatever was the lesser. But anyways, more to the point, it was that in looking back in previous editions, there was very much a sense of consequence when you took things. When you took cyberware, it really felt like you were, you know, cutting out a piece of your soul, right, and replacing it to gain an edge, right? And that's one of the big feels we wanted to recapture. We felt that Shadowrun 4 lost its way a little bit in going with a, hey, just everything's better. You know, you take this thing, it costs a little bit of money and maybe a little bit of essence right now, but that's not really a big deal and it's just going to make you better forever in this category. Hooray, good for you. So we wanted to bring back this idea that there is a price, there is a cost, there's a consequence, there's a trade-off for everything that you do. And you may gain a little bit of edge in this category, but you're sacrificing something in a different category. A great set piece example of this is the move-by-wire system, which I think is in Shadowrun's second edition. Well, it's in the other editions, but the example that I'm thinking of is in second edition. The move-by-wire system was an initiative enhancement system that made you faster than anything else in the game. It was the best speed boost that you could get.
Was it even faster in Wired 3?
Yes. Okay. You got 4 initiative dice.
What Ooh. Book was this then?
Yeah.
Was this like cyber technology or?
I believe so.
Okay.
If not shadow tech, I can't remember. Anyways, okay. But the device came with a very serious consequence. People that use it will inevitably develop a condition called TLEX, temporal lobe epilepsy, which essentially means that you can take this, but eventually it will destroy your nervous system and you will be struck with debilitating seizures that will essentially...
I was actually about to say that I don't remember a lot about some of that Splat Book stuff from the earlier editions, but I remembered that they had in there some high-end cyberware and bioware that would do things like... give you seizures. I mean, it could do some really nasty stuff.
Well, it described the move-by-wire system. It described it's based on aircraft move-by-wire, and how it described it is it put your body in a constant state of seizure so that when you went to move, you were essentially already moving that direction. That's why you were so fast, but it eventually destroyed your nervous system. And this is a great example of you can gain an edge, but there's a consequence. And that's the kind of thing that we want to bring back. Now, maybe not in that extreme that you're going to get a debilitating disease that's going to ruin your character, but there's going to be trade-offs for everything.
I like that extreme, though. For the best of the enhancements, what price can you put on it but destruction?
Well, I think one of the issues, though, that I had with the rules, as best as I recall them, and if anyone's, you know, got the books and is a rules lawyer, they'll probably crucify me on this because I don't think I'll get it right. But as best as I recall them, a lot of the rules created this issue where there was a problem, but the problem is something that looms out in the future. Once again, another one, I'm just riffing off the top of my head here, but in Rifts, I think the same thing is true of the Juicer, that in the long run, they have a lot of problems, but the immediate term, they don't have that many problems. And so the temptation becomes as a player with mechanics like that, well, yeah, I'm playing with fire, but no big deal. I'll play the character, and as soon as I get burned, I'll ditch the character.
Yeah, I'll get myself killed and re-roll. Yeah. Or my GM is never going to run a 30-year-long campaign.
Precisely. So
I'll take this flaw
we'll
that
all the stim packs all day long.
Right after the campaign's over.
Yeah, exactly.
This character's balls will be shriveled up in 10 years, but the camera will stop rolling by then, so I don't care.
By then, my Major League Baseball career will be over anyway, so who cares? And so I think there's kind of a metagame problem with those kinds of drawbacks. So you can have some, certainly in other cases, that were immediate, that were also severe. But I think in a lot of cases, if you either put them on a risk or you put them on a long-term return, then what happens is a player looks at that and they really don't internalize that risk. They say, well, this might happen, but it's probably not. And if it does, it's going to be somewhere out in the future. And then if it actually comes up, all of a sudden, you know, they're shocked by it and ditch the character and they're done and they're out. And so they kind of reap the benefits without ever actually dealing with any kind of a balancer in the midterm. And this is an area where I'll have to give a game like Battletech some credit. You know, for example, you take a PPC, 10 points of damage, 10 points of heat. But it also maxes out at what I think it's an 18 hex range and has a 3 hex minimum range.
21, I think. Is it 18?
I believe it's 18. Then the ERPPC, you now get the 21 hex range.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, my PPC on my last P-Hawk was an ER.
Right, you get the 21 hex range, no minimum range, but it now does 15 points of heat. You know, there's a pretty immediate and also persistent drawback. It's not something you're taking a risk on or you're putting off to the future. It's something that you take immediately in the form of a trade-off.
You can always disengage the minimum range on a standard BPC and then take a risk.
Well, yeah, but once again, it's a pretty immediate risk. Yeah.
Well, and in fourth edition Shadowrun, I feel like there is hardly any consequences for what you do take. And so people just take everything. Like, Yeah, even on a post on the forum, I talked about, somebody was like, I'm getting ready to make a Shadowrun character. I'm like, do not ignore cyberware because it does great things. And I really hope that I don't have to make that comment again in 5th edition for that reason. I think that the consequences are a great thing.
Well, it leads me to a question here. 5th edition is based on 4th edition, but how much of that did you guys look back at previous editions and say, they got it right in 2nd edition, they messed it up in 4th edition, as an example?
A lot, actually. Especially if you're fans of 3rd edition, there is a lot of strong elements that are coming back that you're going to be happy with. And if you're sitting there looking and thinking, man, what I'd really like out of 5th edition is some of this great stuff from 4th edition, and then some of my favorite stuff from 3rd edition, if we could just, you know, like jam it back in there, you're going to be happy.
Now, is anything changing with the history?
That was also one of the other things that came up, is that there was going to be no severe retcons. The history remains intact. We think the long history of Shadowrun is one of its strengths. So that's one of the things that we wanted to maintain.
I hope you bring back the three-part damage system from 1st edition. That was great.
Oh, light, medium, severe, and deadly?
No, I mean, like, well, more than that, like the 5M3 or whatever.
Oh, yeah, you needed a different number of dice to stage an up and down.
Yeah.
That was only in 1st edition.
No, 1st edition was a damn nightmare. That was the only book in my life where I was actually trying to read the rules. There is a skill that they teach you in school that you presuppose is going to be absolutely useless, which is diagramming a sentence. And 1st edition Shadowrun is the only time in my life where I actually found a use for diagramming a sentence, because trying to understand the rules of 1st edition Shadowrun, there were a few places where I had to stop and diagram the sentence to even understand what phrase was modifying what to get at the intention of the rule. 2nd edition did a lot to clean that up. 2nd edition needed to be done, and I'm glad it was done. And holy crap, if you're bringing back anything from 1st edition, then send me some of those Seattle mushrooms. And
clarity and simplicity is top of our mind when we're writing as well. Kind of getting back to the list, the overall design, then the next point, one of the biggest ones, is that we wanted to put the emphasis on the players. The players and their characters are the heroes of the story, and specifically their abilities that make up their core, their attributes and skills. We felt that towards the end of 4th edition, the emphasis was far too much on the character's gear and the stuff that you could buy, and you could compensate for player character weaknesses far too much by simply purchasing gear. And, you know, there were people that would run the numbers and say, it is literally not efficient to purchase this ability with my skill points. I can purchase it with gear bonuses and be getting, you know, a far better ratio of dice for what I invest, as opposed to getting it as a skill. And the problem with that is then it really made things difficult, especially for new players, because then to really make an efficient character to compete with the veterans to be effective, you had to scour through all of these gear books and find the combination so that you could stack up all your bonuses to make an effective character. And we wanted to get rid of kind of that obfuscation of too much gear. So the emphasis is on your characters, and more specifically, it is on your attributes and your skills. If you want to be good at something in Shadowrun 5, get a good skill and a good related attribute. End of story.
Sure. And that's something that's obviously not unique to Shadowrun. I mean, I've seen the same thing in the D&D/Pathfinder world. If you come into the game as a total newbie and just pick what looks cool, you may be making a very, very terrible character.
Especially feats.
Yeah, because there is a lot there.
Toughness, yay!
There is a lot there in terms of the usefulness of feats, the way that different classes play. Yeah, a spell that kind of looks great on paper, but in practice really isn't all that effective.
This does something awesome, but I didn't know there was a save against it.
Yeah, or maybe it does something that doesn't look that great, but, well, it goes against will, which fighters aren't that good at, which means you can shut down your primary enemy on the battlefield in no time at all. And you really had to come into the game with a lot of knowledge of how that game works to make a great character. And you have to come in at least with a mediocre knowledge to make a mediocre character. And we've watched people on our forums, it's kind of become something of a Sunday sport to sit around and get these people to make just these really super min-maxed characters that can do outlandish things. And I don't have a problem with that. I mean, if people enjoy doing that, that's perfectly fine. And there are games out there that are made for those people that love the simulation and love the math. But I certainly think it does make a game somewhat more difficult to approach This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.